So we are working our way through the Gospel of Mark. And that story is in Mark chapter 7, which is the chapter that we're going to look at today together. In case you're reading through it. The nice thing about picking Mark, I really like Mark for a couple of reasons. But one nice thing about Mark is that it's the shortest Gospel. So if you want to read it, you can read through it pretty quickly. And I imagine that it was intended to mostly be read like that, the story all in one grouping, not necessarily pulled apart the way that we do, but we're so far removed. I had a professor, I guess I'm kind of jumping ahead, but the original version of Mark doesn't have any resurrection appearances. The resurrection appearances were added later. It's really interesting. The original version of Mark ends where they leave the empty tomb. That's where the story ends in Mark's account of the gospel. And I had a professor who had helped with the translation of the ESV and then written a commentary on the gospel of Mark. And there's some theories about Mark. Some people think because it's the shortest, it was the first one written. It's most concise and straight to the point, and that's why there's no resurrection appearances. And that's why there's a problematic portions of that. This professor felt like it was the last one, and that the point was to tell the generation, because if you can imagine, you know, when John writes his gospel, even though he's old, or Matthew, when Matthew writes his gospel, he not only knew Jesus when Jesus was here, but he saw the resurrection of Jesus, right, before he ascended. And even in Paul's epistles, when he writes it in the 60s and stuff, he says that there, most of the people, the 500 to whom Jesus appeared, are still around, says, though some have fallen asleep. So when we get to the later books of the Bible, it starts to be less common that people will know folks who saw the resurrected Jesus. And so it starts to get tricky for them to go. And the one theory about Mark's gospel is the idea that trying to drive home that you don't have to have seen the resurrected Jesus in order to be captured by the gospel. And that the gospel can work. That's a long way of giving us an excuse for not reading Mark all at once, but breaking it down to Jesus, because we've got to learn something here. And we're going to learn a little bit in Mark chapter 7. I want to look first at the story of the Syrophoenician woman, chapter 7, verse 24. And one thing that's worth noting here is, like, sometimes the New Testament, people feel like that it's male-dominated, that it's exclusionary to women, and culturally they were following some norms, maybe as they taught in groups and stuff. But one of the things that's worth noting is how many times women are the examples of faith, whether we're talking about Mary or Mary Magdalene or the woman at the well, or in this case, the Syrophoenician woman. This is an example of faith. It's like aspirational, the kind of person that we want to be in the world. And so Mark includes this story. Let's look at it together. Chapter 7, verse 24. And from there he arose, Jesus, and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house. And he did not want anyone to know. Yet he could not be hidden. I was reading about the geography here, and the way Jesus walks here, he's definitely walking up all the way out of the way. He's trying to go around the region of the Israelites, probably because one of the Herods he had already made mad. Remember in Mark's gospel, Jesus is trying to kind of not have people get mad at him too fast. Because he's trying to do some work, probably for the disciples and the region, and he doesn't, he's here for the crucifixion, but he has to come at the right time, so he's healing people and telling them to keep quiet, and he's avoiding this region where one of the Herods has put the word out on him. And so he gets into this region of Tyre and Sidon, and he's trying to keep keep it down, try to keep a secret that he's moving through there. Verse 25, but immediately, remember in Mark's gospel, everything happens immediately, but immediately a woman whose little daughter was possessed by an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, not an Israelite, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she begged him to cast a demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the little children be fed first, for it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Tough, not what you expect from Jesus, right? She's a Gentile, she's not an Israelite. Her daughter is oppressed by this demon. So like the first thing to think about is like, it doesn't seem like she's surprised that that he would respond to her this way. She doesn't get offended. She knows the situation she's coming to. She knows she's a Gentile, not an Israelite. He's an Israelite rabbi, right? And she comes anyway. She also knows he's trying to keep hidden because when he goes to other places, he's got like a number of big groups of people following him. They're chasing him around the lake. Here he comes in. Remember, he's already also had the time where he's teaching and they can't even get into the house and lower the guy down through the roof. Like, he's had big crowds of people. This, not an Israelite, the woman, she comes right to him, no trouble, which means Jesus is outside of the region where he's known well. He just said he's probably doing that on purpose, and he's trying to keep hidden. This woman knows she's out on a limb coming to him. The thing that is interesting to me is how very clear her problem is. I mean, it's like abstract to me and you. The kid's possessed by a demon. I don't know what the symptoms are of that. I don't know. But to her, this is a clear problem. She knows the ask, and she doesn't have another place to go. And I was just thinking, like, I don't know. Do you feel like you've been in that spot very often? Like, where I was trying to, like, this woman we're going to find is a very clear example for us to follow. And the first place, if we're going to follow her example, is like she understands her need so much that she goes to Jesus when he's trying to avoid people, though she knows he's not really for her. This little phrase that you shouldn't take what is meant to the children and give it to the dogs, it's like you could soften it a little bit, like culturally, it's like a pet, not like a kick the dog in the alleyway kind of thing, but like the pet dog, like the little deer dog, you know, that's like around underneath. But you made dinner for the kids. You don't take it off the table and put it down and give it to the ones for whom it was not intended. This is what Jesus is saying. I've come for the Israel. I'm an Israelite rabbi, not for the Gentiles. Okay. And I said already, but we'll look at it here. She doesn't really seem fazed. Now the woman was a Gentile Syrophoenician, and she begged him. And then Jesus said, let the little children be fed first, for it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Verse 28, but she answered, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.
The first thing about that, right, is that she's like can recognize that all she needs is the crumbs of the meal. Like, that this problem, who nobody else can solve, is like not a big deal for Jesus. He's not near this daughter. Like, she's somewhere else. this woman, whom she recognizes that what Jesus came to do is not really for her, at least not yet, but she's like, just give me a little something. So she has this confidence that Jesus can do it. But the thing that got me is she also has like some notion that he would break protocol or rules. Like it would not be appropriate for him to go into her house. She's a Gentile, he's an Israelite. The relationship here, for him to do something for her, is not only that he would have to do something that she perceives to be easy and other people might perceive would be hard, but also that he has some like care or concern for her that's outside of the norm or tradition or... Okay. So I think Mark puts this story here right after the one before it on purpose, if you back up a little bit. Really to the beginning of chapter 7, it says the Pharisees gathered to Jesus with some scribes from Jerusalem, and they saw some of the disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, they were unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands, holding to the tradition of their elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. This is, for what it's worth, the reason, the fact that Mark goes through and explains all of this tells us that the people he's anticipating reading it won't be Israelites. They'll probably be people outside of Israelite culture, because if you were in Israelite culture, you'd know the Pharisees were real sticklers for all of these things. And so you wouldn't need the whole explanation. Mark gives the whole explanation just to give us, some Gentiles out there in the world, some context. Hey, these guys were real sticklers for the rules. And then after he's demonstrated that, remember when they asked about why don't they just wash their hands? It wasn't like washing our hands now, you know, just like having a bowl. It was very ceremonial. And it was like demonstrated, like done in whenever you went to eat in a really self-righteous way, like, oh, wait, where's your bowl for the food? We always do the figure. You don't do the figure. You know, it's like maybe sometimes if you were to go to eat with somebody and you sat down and started eating and they're like, won't you pray before you? We always pray. You know, it's like that, right? We always pray. It's like, so he's like, the guys are real sticklers for the rules. And then Jesus goes on, and then in the next section, he says, verse 14. And he called some people to him again and said to them, hey, guys, understand this. There's nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile. But the things that come out of a person are what defile. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked, what are you talking about? Verse 16, and he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Don't you see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters in, not into his heart, but into his stomach and is expelled. And then Mark puts in parentheses for us Gentiles who don't get the emphasis of what Jesus said, thus he declared all food clean. Remember the cleanliness laws? Remember, like, in the Old Testament, they have, like, three types of ways to engage with animals for food? And there's this one section over here that is good for sacrifices. This is not just any lamb, but a certain kind of lamb. Not just any heifer, but a certain kind of cow. Not just any bird, but a certain kind of bird. Pure, blameless. These are sacrificial, worthy animals. Then the next one is they have like food-worthy animals. And it has to do with whether there's a cleft in the hoof or not. You know, like, this is why Israelites don't hang out pigs, because pigs have a cleft hoof. And so you can't eat the pigs. so they have a certain kind of food that's okay for sacrifices, then a certain kind of food that's not okay for sacrifices but is okay for eating, then they have unclean animals like the pig out here. So there's three types, right? And so then very meticulously, the Israelite people would go to a home and then they would keep, you know, the milk apart from other parts. They follow all these food rules. And Jesus right here, just very casually, is telling his disciples, don't you get what I said, man? The food rules are over. Food rules are over. The food rules have been in place for a long time. If Jesus is blowing out the food rules, we should know, like, was it silly the whole time? Because it seems like God institutes it. Best we know about food rules is that these food rules mimic the rules for separation for Israel. So Israel has a group of people that are capable of being priests and making the sacrifices. And then Israel is able to enter the temple when you keep the rules. Then you can be a pure and clean Israelite. And then the unclean food is parallel to all the Gentiles out there in the world that are unclean. And so the food laws help the Israelites understand they are set aside for something different. When Jesus abolishes the food laws, it's not as though he's saying this was wrong. He's saying, we don't need the lions anymore. And then he's saying that stuff from outside coming in doesn't make you clean anymore. Cleanliness can come from the inside, out of you. Mark quotes, or Jesus quotes this passage and from Isaiah, the people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Oh, interesting. Teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. So making the rules of men, like rules we made up, equal to the rules of God. I was looking this quote up. It's from Isaiah chapter 29. And there's one more sentence right at the end that gets kind of truncated. Remember we said that sometimes rabbis would quote an Old Testament section and then you were supposed to know the next verse that comes? So by quoting these two verses, then they're encouraging you to look at the one that comes right after it. Because if you're a good disciple, you've got the whole Old Testament memorized. And like a good Taylor Swift song, when you sing the first two, you know the line that comes next, right? That's what he's expecting them to do with Isaiah. And so like Isaiah says, because the people draw near with their mouth and honor me with their lips while their hearts are far from me. This is the part that got left out. And their fear of me is a commandment taught by men. Fear is a tough translation. It can mean love, respect, deep respect that looks to something in hope. Jesus is saying that when being a person of God becomes all about following the right rules, the whole thing sours and is worthless. And so he's trying to get the disciples to understand, look, I don't care anymore where you come from. I care what comes out of your heart. And so the very next story that Mark puts for us is the one about the Syrophoenician woman who's in the wrong part of the country, comes to Jesus, who's hiding all by herself, handles the reasonable rebuff of Jesus, and yet presses in. And yet presses in and says that somehow she has the confidence that Jesus could override the norm. And then what happens? Let's see, verse 28. And she answered him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child
lying in bed and being gone. That's a great story, isn't it? And, like, I love what it says about what God is accomplishing in the person of Jesus. I love that it says, no one is too far gone. There's not a right place to be from or a right way to behave that opens up the opportunity for God to work for you. I like that the good church folk who are following all the rules don't even understand what Jesus said, and the Syrophoenician woman who has not heard the rules. Like, she wasn't there when he was describing to the Pharisees and the disciples that it doesn't matter what goes into you, it matters what comes out to you. She just knew she really needed something that she thought only Jesus could do. This is what I'm trying to say. It's okay for you to be in a place in your life where you really need something and you don't know how the problem will be solved. This doesn't mean that you are weak, that you've done something wrong, that you are on the wrong side of the rule or the law. To be in a place of deep need is actually realistic. And these are the ones, Jesus says over and over again, these are the ones for whom he came. The Pharisees had the rules and were doing fine. They had no need of a Savior. He came for the ones who needed to be saved. I hope you have some places where you need some salvation. Because Jesus' fixes are better than yours. Jesus' salvation is better than your own. It transcends the rules, the cultural norms, the reach of your intellect, your network, your dollars, your self-talk. It reaches beyond anything you could conjure or imagine. I'm saying the salvation of Jesus does. And so, it's okay, as a matter of fact, it is good to be in a place where you need Jesus. Remember, we talked about it before, but Apostle Paul, right? He wrote three quarters of the New Testament, started like 13 churches at least, walked around Asia Minor multiple times, survived stonings and shipwreck and being bit by serpents. He wasn't always a zealous for Jesus. Before he was a zealous for Jesus, he was a zealous for the Pharisees, you know, he oversaw the stoning of Stephen. He was a disciple of Gamaliel, maybe the best rabbi of his age, really smart guy. There's one little phrase that gets pulled out from Paul a lot. Remember when he's like, he talks about how he has that thorn in his side? And he wishes that Jesus would get rid of it, but he figures he leaves it. And sometimes I have friends who are like, yeah, I have this thing, but I'm just like the thorn in my side. Another, Jesus just leaves it for me. And I remember Ron one time told me, you remember that? Yeah. We had this pastor in college who was like really good for us at the right time of our life. And, you know, it's like you're a college kid and you're trying to be good. And you're like, I don't know if this is ever going to be solved. I don't know if Jesus will ever deal with this. You know, I mean, Paul had the thorn in his side. And I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I figured you and Paul are about the same thing. Paul had a deep tendency to figure he knew how to do everything. Because Paul was some, like, top 10 intellect in the history of humanity. Jesus made a special trip out of heaven to convert Saul on the road to Damascus and get him to be called to recruit him to work for the church. We can anticipate that we can have that God can communicate to us the love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control that we need to live. And when we have places where we are short, where peace is robbed, where joy is fleeting, where anxiety reigns, where stress dominates, we can press in. That's a calling to come like the Syrophoenician woman to the feet of the one who gives solutions. That's not a thing to put up with. That's a thing to go to the feet of Jesus. That he died on the cross that you might have love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, and self-control. I'm saying if you need some help finding places where you need salvation, that's a place to start also. But that's what the life you bought on the cross looks like. You might as well start at time. We can keep going, but you get the point. Jesus can save the ones who need saving. We might as well be those ones. Let me pray that you can do that. Hey, Lord, thank you for the gift of the cross, the sacrifice of your Son, and what it means for us. We know that you can save us, so we ask that you would today. In Jesus' name, we pray.